This is Talk Is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. All right, this week, Jonathan Kitaab from November 16th here in Eugene. Jonathan Kitaab is co-founder of the Palestinian Human Rights Group, Al-Haq, and co-founder of Nonviolence International, a well-known international human rights attorney. Jonathan practices in the U.S., Palestine, and Israel. He serves on the board of Bethlehem Bible College and is president of the board of Holy Land Trust. Jonathan was the head of the legal committee negotiating the Cairo Agreement of 1994 between Israel and the PLO. After graduating with his Doctor of Jurisprudence from Virginia Law School and practicing a couple of years on Wall Street, Jonathan returned home to Palestine. Jonathan was visiting scholar at Osgoode Law School at York University in Toronto in the fall of 2017 and is a founding director of Just Peace Advocates Movement Por Un Pai, Pejust, a Canadian-based international law human rights not-for-profit organization. Pardon my French. Jonathan is currently the executive director of Friends of Sabil North America, or FOSNA. Jonathan is a resident of East Jerusalem and is a partner of Kitaab, Khoury, and Hanna Law Firm in East Jerusalem. Jonathan Kitaab's articles have appeared in the Middle East Institute, Arab News, Arab Center, Washington, D.C., Al Jazeera, the Electronic Intifada, and others. All right, so that, and then I have the Q&A next week, too, because this went a little over an hour, thanks to Todd Boyle for the recording. And so I have a little time. I've been researching Rojava. So, and you want to go to defendrojava.org if you want to learn more about the anarchist experiment that's going on in Rojava. Defend and support them because they're on their own out there, basically. And I'm in the middle of this book called Hope Without Hope by Matt Broomfield. And so let me just read you a couple of excerpts from that just to get you up to speed on Rojava as much as we can. Very complicated issue there. Complicated, but simple. Basically, they're, you know, they don't want to join a statist, join a nation state or, you know, like the U.S. or Turkey or any of those, and don't want to create a state of Kurdistan, and but also don't want to be a jihadist either. So in that turmoil, a autonomous zone has been created. So let me get to... All right, so this is from the introduction. The Rojava Revolution, Victory Amid Defeats. Just like many of our other diverse movements across the global left, the Kurdish movement has spent the past three decades reckoning with bloody repression, fragmentation, and above all, a despairing sense that mass social information is no longer possible in the 21st century. The Rojava Revolution is not merely a fascinating experiment or utopian outlier, but directly bound up in global crisis affecting us all. The Arab Spring wave of pro-democratic protests that engulfed the Middle East in 2011 is commonly seen as having resulted in widespread defeat, repression, and exploitation by both authoritarian governments and jihadist Islamists. And the Rojava Revolution is trying to stay right in between those two. Between authoritarian governments and jihadist Islamists. The so-called Arab winter brought terrible suffering to Syria, where Director Bashar al-Assad crushed a nationwide civil uprising at the cost of up to 500,000 lives. This facilitated the rapid takeover of the opposition by state-backed jihadist groups, a shift that would ultimately culminate in Assad's 2024 deposition by an authoritarian al-Qaeda offshoot. By the way, this book is just out, 2025, by al-Qaeda offshoot Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. Yet it was through these very uprisings that the Kurdish movement sought to revolutionize society throughout northern Syria, claiming to implement the unique system of grassroots municipal governance they call democratic confederalism. In the course of this revolution, Kurdish militants have battled not only drone strikes and ethnic cleansing, but also the same challenges faced by many of us on the global left each day: pessimism, despair, and suicide. Yet the existential nature of the struggle, the repeated losses and terrible sacrifices, enabled the Kurdish government to unite 4 million Kurds, Arabs, and ethnic minority Christians and Yazidis. This tentative and unexpected multi-ethnic polity is formally known as the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria, or AANES. So yeah, you can support that movement, and it's going to be an example to the rest of the world, hopefully, similar to the Zapatista movement, by going to defendrojava.org. That's defendrojava.org. All right, so coming up, Jonathan Kitab from November 16th here in Eugene. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media.
Thank you very much. The topic that has been assigned to me is to try and give you a view of what I think the future is going to be like for Palestine, Israel, Holy Land, whatever you want to call it. And it's a very important question to ask, because I think people recognize the current situation as a critical moment when people are really being called upon to do some new thinking, where we can't continue with the old process of thinking, which hasn't gotten us anywhere, where the situation is really a situation of crisis, not just for the people of Israel and Palestine, but for the entire world, because the foundations on which international law and international relations have been built are being questioned and are being ignored. And I don't mean that only in the legal sense, that people no longer, you know, respect international law and international conventions and international courts and international relations are being openly disregarded, but also because we see before our eyes things that used to occur only in the dark, that people would look at, you know, years after, oh, we didn't know these things were happening. How is it possible that something like that could take place? This is what people were saying about the Holocaust. We didn't know that it was happening, whether they knew or not. Today, there is no question. Everybody knows. It's out there. There's a good reason why people refuse to call it by its name, genocide. Because if you do, then there are consequences. If this is actually a genocide taking place, then there's a legal obligation to do something about it. And failure to do something about it is a violation of international law and of your own human obligation as a human being. How could that happen? Things that used to be done in the dark are now being done openly. Using starvation as a weapon, determining how much food is going to be allowed in or not. Removing the distinction between combatant and non-combatant, creating a new category called Hamas. So whether you are armed or unarmed, whether you are doing, you're a doctor or a policeman or a firefighter or a teacher, if you can be labeled Hamas, then both you and your family and your institution are legitimate targets that can be destroyed with everything around it. Doesn't work. We can't live in a world that is so lacking in standards, in values, in principles, in laws and obligations. If that is true, and if we really care at all about those human beings called Israelis or Palestinians or Arabs or Jews, whatever, then we must do some soul searching. We must go back to the principles and say, what is this conflict all about? What are the ideologies? What are the thought processes? What are the what's the problem? Why can't we solve it? And as a person who's been very involved in this for quite some time, I'd like to present you with a formula. Tries as much as possible to be non-judgmental. And I would like to say that without making any false equivalency between the two sides, because there isn't, we see two movements or two ideologies or two groups that have diametrically opposite ideas. One of them, and I'll start with the Palestinian one, says, Palestine Arabi, Palestine is Arab. What are you talking about? People living in Palestine can be Jewish, Christian, or Muslim, but they're Arabs. And they've been there for centuries. They've lived together, for better or for worse. And they want to be free, and they want to be democratic, and they want to live in a independent society. We were part of the third world that got rid of colonialism and imperialism. And then this is who we are. We belong to the land. We are part of it. You can't just come in from all over the world and say, you know, this is your place and not ours, and we don't belong here. We belong to the land. This is our land. And this force, which I will briefly call Palestinian nationalism or Palestinian Arab nationalism, has to deal with another force, which I will call Zionism. I know there are different kinds of Zionism, but the kind that prevailed and that we are experiencing today says we want a place, a state that's as Jewish as France is French. We want a Jewish state. Because we've been persecuted all over the world, particularly in the Western Christian world, and the persecution reached its height in the Holocaust. We can't trust anybody. We can't trust international law. We want our own state to be as Jewish as France is French. The old slogan was, a land without a people for a people without a land. And what better place than our ancient homeland of 3,000 years ago, where we once had a state and which we're connected to historically, religiously, whatever reason. It belongs to us. Anybody else living there, really don't belong. Let them go somewhere else. Let them find a solution somewhere else. So these two movements, these two ideologies, let's face it, are mutually exclusive and are caught in a zero-sum conflict. The more we have, the less they have. And the elements of that conflict are demography and land. The more people we can bring in, Jews, and keep out, Arabs, the more Jewish we can become. And for the Arabs, this is our land. What do you mean? What are you talking about? Where do we go? This is our land. We don't go somewhere else. And land becomes important also. Ownership and use of the land, not only in terms of who owns it, is it a Jewish or a non-Jewish person, but then it becomes institutional. That land that we take and put in the public domain is here to serve only Jews and to serve them forever, and it should not be alienated. At best, we will give it a 49-year lease and only to a Jewish person. The state, the Jewish state, will ultimately own it, not the individual. So these two movements are in conflict, are in contradiction. Again, I'm trying desperately to avoid making judgments, moral, historical, or legal. And please be clear, I am not saying the two claims, the two ideologies are in any way equivalent or similar. But they are there, and each group has a lot of supporters outside who are pumping money, diplomatic support, weapons in to its group at the expense of the other. 1947, actually before that, with the help of Great Britain and many other countries, you brought in more and more Jews in because they were being kicked out of Europe or fleeing the Nazi onslaught. And the Arabs were seeing their land being inundated, and they were afraid that they will become minority in their own land, so they resisted, they refused to accept it. And so somebody said, come and say, let's divide it and make it a Jewish and Arab. And the Arab says, what do you mean divide my country and give up most of it to somebody else who's just coming just because they were persecuted in Europe? It's not our fault. So the Arabs rejected the petition resolution. The Jew says, yes, we'll take it for the time being, because we really want more, but we'll take it for now. And that's how the State of Israel was created in 1948. The Arabs did not accept that, and the Jews were very glad that now they have taken the land and made sure that most of its population was kicked out and kept out, very important. You know, they'll tell you they left on their own, or their own leaders told them to leave, or regardless, the truth is, for whatever reason they left, they were not allowed back in. Because how could you allow them back in? If you're trying to create a Jewish state, you wanted more Jews to come in, and you wanted more non-Jews to be out. 1967, very pivotal time, when there was another war, the 67 war. Don't tell me who started it, because the ones who actually started shooting were the Israelis, but they claimed it was preemptive self-defense. We knew they were going to attack us, so we attacked them first. Never mind who started it, it was a defensive war, and we ended up winning, we took all the land. But we really didn't want to take the land because, we want peace. We're willing to give back that land in return for peace. If they will accept that we keep 78% of Palestine, they can have the rest of the land, the 22%, and they can do whatever they want with it. That's what I call the Great Compromise, that so-called two-state solution. There was a big deception, actually, we now know. The Israelis never intended to give up that land. And why do we know? Because they started putting up Jewish settlement all over the West Bank and Gaza. And they started settling Jews there to the point where today there's 700,000-800,000 Jewish settlers living in the occupied territories. And they, not only physically the number of Jews who moved in, but the structures that were created, the legal structures with separate courts, separate laws, separate roads, separate services, separate everything. One set for the Jews and one set for the non-Jews. I happen to be, like many of you probably, like many churches, like many states, we thought this compromise of a two-state solution was a reasonable compromise, not the best, not the most fair, but one that made sense. Especially since the state of Israel said, we don't want this land. We didn't start this war to take land. All we want is peace. So it was land for peace. We'll give you back the land that we took in 67. In return, you accept the Jewish state and you allow us to have the land we took before 67. Jerusalem, we'll take it. We'll keep it. But we want an exit formally. We will call it, we'll apply Israeli law and administration to it. And we'll basically keep it. But it'll be up for negotiations. And the Arab world says, okay, all right, we'll accept that. The Arab peace plan or the Saudi peace plan was, we will accept Israel, we'll have total and full peace and normalization and everything else. You'll go back to the 67 borders and maybe we will share Jerusalem. And the Israelis were not interested. At some point, I and many others realized that the two-state solution is not going to happen. That so many changes were made, so many facts were created on the ground, so much was done psychologically to integrate the occupied territories and keep it under Israeli control, that it was no longer possible to really talk about a two-state solution. Nonetheless, people continue to talk about it. It continues to be the official position of many groups, including some churches, including countries at the United Nations. So when I reached the point where I realized the two-state solution was not going to happen, I said, well, what do we do then? How do we deal with this new reality? The new reality is that there are two groups that are living in the land today, roughly 7 million each. 7 million Jews and 7 million non-Jews, Palestinians, Arab. Now, it's true the Arabs are fragmented into Gaza, West Bank, East Jerusalem, what's called Israeli Arabs who are Palestinians with Israeli passports, as well as a large group who are refugees outside, no right of return, no hope of returning. But the reality is, the two groups today coexist and live in the same land under one regime, which is the Israeli regime, which has fragmented and subdivided them into different localities. Now, when the Palestinians rise up, as happened during the Intifada, or when they resist with military force, as happened October 7, then the Israelis say, huh, we're being attacked. Our security is impinged. We want peace, but we want to keep all the land. We want peace, but we want control. So what is the solution? Is there a solution? Is it possible to satisfy the needs of both sides? I happen to think it is. In fact, I'm bold enough to say that there is a solution that can give each side, everything its ideology demands, except for exclusivity. In other words, you can have what you want as long as the other side also has something. Now, I remember talking to a rabbi in New Jersey, and I say, please explain this to me. You are a Zionist, you want a Jewish state, right? What's a Jewish state? What does a Jewish state do for you? Why do you want the Jewish state? I mean, what is a Jewish state after all? You can't circumcise a piece of rock. And he says, well, after everything that happened to us, I want a place where any Jew, anywhere, anytime, no questions asked, can go and live and be able to defend himself. I got inspired. I said, I can give you something better. How about a state where any Jew, anywhere, anytime, no questions asked, can go and live where he doesn't need to defend himself? Because nobody's out to get him. I said, is that possible? I said, yes. You only have to give up one thing. Exclusivity. You have to change your ideology, your Zionism, to incorporate the possibility of somebody else also living in the land with full rights and full dignity and full expression. And I too, as a Palestinian, have to change my ideology, where I talk about Palestine Arabiya. Palestine is Arab. Half the people living in it are not Arab. They're Jewish. And they're going nowhere. So yes, it can be Palestine Arabiya, but also Jewish. Is it possible to have a state that is both Jewish and Arab at the same time, that guarantees the rights of both? So I said, I'm going to do a little thought experiment. I'm going to ask my Jewish friends, as I did the rabbi, what is it that you want? What does Zionism promise you? Well, we want a state that has, that follows the Jewish calendar, whether we are religious or not. Good. Can be done. We want a state with a right of return for Jews. So any Jew anywhere who's persecuted can come and live here, as of right. Can be done. What else? Well, we want freedom and democracy to participate in the life of the country. Can be done. And I asked my Palestinian friends, what is it that we really want? Why do we want a state? Why do we want a state? Why do we want a Palestinian state? Well, so that we can be free, okay? We want a passport. Why? So that we can travel. If you give me a passport, but you don't allow me to travel, to leave and to come, what good is it to me? We want dignity, equality, our language, our culture. Can be done. Can be done. Both of them can be done if we give up the concept of exclusivity. In fact, I would argue that you end up with a state that is better for Jews than the state of Israel, and better for Palestinian Arabs than any of the Arab states that we see around us. So I set up to write up this idea in a little book called Beyond the Two-State Solution. It's available out there, or you can download it for free if you want. It even has a little exclusive executive summary that describes it in a few pages. It requires a constitution that protects each group as well as the individual from the caprice of the majority, so that whoever has 51% of the Electoral College votes can still say this is my country and can still feel protected. See, people have the wrong idea of what democracy is. Democracy doesn't mean that 51% can trample the rights of the minorities or of the individual. Right? If you do that also, you don't have to worry about the demographic demon who has more people. Because people can vote then for whoever they want. And not necessarily vote always on their ethnic identity. And yes, the majority will control the government, but then they will be controlled by the Constitution. They can't pass laws and they can't have practices that violate the rights of the minority. There has to be some very clear, robust mechanisms to ensure that whoever has 51% will not be able to trample the rights of the others. So I started writing this thing up and say, well, what's wrong with it? What are the objections? Well, somebody says, what about security? The Israelis are so obsessed with security. Okay, I can understand that. So we'll have a mechanism. Actually, I have two solutions for Israeli security. The first is, all right, the defense minister, the head of the army, and navy, and air force, and nuclear commission, whatever, will always be a Jewish person with an Arab deputy. But the head of the internal security, the police security services, will always be a Palestinian Arab with a Jewish deputy. Because we also have our history. We also have suffered from people discriminating against us. Every other position in the army or the navy or the police will be on the basis of merit. And those who do not wish to fight and participate, like myself, I'm a pacifist, can do national service that is appropriate. Secondly, 10% of the defense budget has to go to a special department to deal with the causes of hatred and enmity and injustice between Arabs and Jews. Teach people each other's language and tradition and history. Work on joint programs. Work on dealing with the trauma that you have experienced. Work on compensation and dealing with the injustices that have happened. Because frankly, the biggest danger to Jewish Israelis today doesn't come from Iran or Turkey, or it comes from a 12-year-old Palestinian girl with a scissors in her pocket that she wants to stick into somebody. And she doesn't care who or why or what, because she feels injustice. If you can address the feelings of injustice. You want the right of return? Well and good. But so do Palestinians. They want the right of return. And you don't have to kick anybody out of their homes, whether they're living in an Arab house in Jaffa that they took over, or in a settlement that they took over in the West Bank. They can stay there, not as lords and masters, but on the basis of equality. And the owner of that house or land will get compensation and other land, other housing from the public sector, because the public now is not the Jewish public. It's the entire public of the new state. And yes, you can absorb refugees. Israel knows how to do that very well. You can absorb the refugees who are returning. They don't have to kick anybody out of their house. They can find them new housing, new land, new opportunities, new training. You can have a proper society. Well, what happens when the Arabs become the majority? Well, you have to have mechanisms in place and institutions to defend whoever is in the minority. And there has to be a constitutional court. You see, maybe it's because I'm a lawyer, but I understand how a constitution is above and beyond the legislature. So if people pass a law that is discriminatory, that's unconstitutional. If a government carries out activities that are discriminatory or racist, that's unconstitutional. There has to be a constitutional court with two Arab, two Jewish judges at least out of five, and the decisions have to be majority decisions. Because you want to create a mechanism that lives for the future, not just for the current situation. Well, I wrote this book and I published it in Arabic and in Hebrew and in English. And I was waiting for responses. Tell me, is there anything wrong with this mechanism, with this idea? Maybe it's not the only solution. Maybe there are other solutions. But at its roots, it is based on giving up the current ideologies which have not served their people. Ideologies based on supremacy, ideologies based on exclusivity, ideologies based on who has power and can force their will upon others, that does not work. Does not work. Has not worked. I think Palestinians are quite convinced of that. Maybe the Israelis need to be convinced that pure power alone will never get you security, will never get you even survival. Now, the truth is, neither side, the Palestinians nor the Israeli side, can survive for very long without the support of outside forces, who can either be part of the problem or part of the solution. And there's no reason why they couldn't be part of the solution, because Palestine, the Holy Land, is in fact very significant for Arabs and for Jews. It's significant for Christians and Muslims and Jews. They all care what happens. It's the Holy Land. It's the place where their religions started. So why doesn't this Holy Land become a place for cooperation, coexistence, understanding, that's open to everybody, but that's not exclusive to anybody? Whether you're talking about Jerusalem, I mean, who dare say that Jerusalem is only for Christians? The Crusaders used to think so. Or only for Muslims. Or only for Jews. It's important for all three. Now, I'll tell you another thing that, at least my way of thinking, my model of thinking, is very positive. You need to have in Palestine civil courts as well as religious courts. Why? Because the current system does not give people full rights, including Jews. Did you know that? If you are a Jewish person who is conservative or reform, you are not recognized in Israel. You cannot marry in Israel. You cannot inherit. You cannot live your life because Zionism made a deal with the Orthodox Jews that the Orthodox only will have jurisdiction in all personal status matters relating to Jews. Did you know that? The head of Israel's Supreme Court, Chaim Cohen, could not marry the love of his life because she was a divorcee. He's a Cohen. Cohens are only supposed to marry virgins. And she's a divorcee. He had to go to New York and get married there to come back and live in Israel as man and wife with her. People don't know that. Because the state of Israel is really messed up. As is the Arab world, many countries in the Arab world. Jordan is the same, Palestine is the same. They have religious courts that have exclusive jurisdiction in personal status affairs. So you can have your religious freedom only if the state is willing both to recognize your religious courts, but also to give you an option to have civil marriage, particularly if you're denomination or religion is not recognized by the state. By the way, Methodist is not one of the recognized states. They're not. They're the only Protestant ones that are recognized are the Lutherans and the Anglicans, and that's because of colonial pressure. Baptists aren't, everybody else isn't. And people who have mixed marriages, God forbid, they don't have religious freedom. So we need new formulae that address the needs of people rather than have the people serve the needs of their ideologies. And again, I say that for Palestinians as well as I say it for Israelis. We need new formulae. We need a new form of government that ends oppression, that ends occupation, that ends military reliance on the military. Now, I happen to be a pacifist. I don't think violence solves anybody's problems. We need to recognize that in Palestine, of all places, violence does not work. It doesn't. It creates destruction, it creates hatred, it creates bitterness and enmities that continue for generations. It creates destruction and traumas that you have to live with for many generations to come and pay the price. At best, it allows you to dominate as long as you are powerful, but sooner or later, you will be weaker. Sooner or later, somebody even as with no power, as Hamas showed on October 7, without an air force, without any tanks, without any military industry that's worth anything, without even lines of supply, they managed to shock the Israeli system and capture military bases, 3 military bases. You didn't know that. You thought all they did was go around and hit civilians. They actually captured 3 military bases, killed over 230 soldiers, and captured 51, including the headquarters of the Gaza Brigade. I know you thought all they did was go around killing civilians and raping women and beheading children, babies. The truth is, both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs desperately need new ideas. Ideas based on equality, based on dignity, based on humanity that are not based on exclusivity. And it is possible. And anybody who fails to provide humanity to the other party is not doing their group any favors. The crisis that we see now within the American Jewish community, for example, is huge, because there are so many decent people who cannot live with what Israel is doing. Not because they love the Palestinians, but because what's happening is so contrary to their values and beliefs and morality. And for Palestinians also, violence does not work. Not that we don't have the right to defend ourselves. Everybody talks about Israel's right to defend itself, right? We have the right to defend ourselves too. But armed resistance and violence does not work for us either. We must find new pathway for peace. Always happens. I take too long. So I will give you an opportunity now to maybe challenge and question me, but I would like to end with a positive note. There will be a new future for Palestinians and Israelis in Israel-Palestine, in this land. But it is only based on equality, human rights, and self-respect. It is not based on eternal enmity. It is not based on superiority. It is not based on dehumanizing the other side. Thank you very much.
What's going on? We are 1876, the world's only powwow punk rock band. We're here to make some noise for you. It's going to get loud, all right? Because we want the people back in the fry bread line to hear us. So we're going to be real loud, all right? So the way we're going to start this off is we're going to have all you guys get your hands together. Start clapping with this drum, all right? Clapping.
That's right, Alonzo.
Woo!
Big Uncle Henry.
Upon a satellite, until the sun would rise and the skyline would turn gold. But I can't see the sunrise anymore. I'm living on these rooftops with rents I can't afford. Surviving in the shadows, casting down from a glass door. I noticed that the stars won't tell the stories anymore. Nothing ever stays cold, that's what I'm told. Oh, I'm riding through the city like I'm going. Oh, give a roof full of house that I'll never own. I'm not wanting to hear no more. Oh, I'm not wanting to hear no more. Come and take my parents home away. For somebody with mom and dad, my name. has moved to town and wants to stay the blame. Pushing the ones I love out on the street.
The world's only powwow punk rock band.
Woo!
We come from the Blackfeet, the Northern Cheyenne, and the Oglala. And before we started playing, we had our flags up here. And then I think the Indians spirits that used this is their land were just like, nah, they blew them down. So we are from the city, but we're not from this land, but we are from this land. You know what I mean? If anybody tells you different, you come tell them to talk to us. We can help educate them.
We're talking ourselves for you, boss.